Tom Arnold, compassion, manipulation, and attribution, facilitating care and human AI interactions. Take it away, Thomas.
Thank you. And I'll give a shout out to Thomas Patrick Arnold, who I think is, I don't know if, hey, you're here. Okay, good. We have meetings every month, and you know, the Thomas Arnold Society. please attend Thomas's talk tomorrow on high school education, which is very interesting. So I work in the computer science department in human-robot interaction, but my background is in religious studies. So I live a pretty farcical, at times comical, existence of being the person at the table who brings a different type of secondary literature, a different type of educational path, but it's been a rich collaboration, and I think my colleague Cyrus and Mark also have some of those backgrounds of taking different fields into account. Let's make sure we can advance here. All right. And I wish we could go through things more slowly, but this will be a whirlwind tour where I try to put together what we do in human-robot interaction and what I do as someone in the now pretty vacuous term AI ethics. Back 10 years ago, it had some traction. It had a little bit of granularity to it. But after the HBO series Silicon Valley and other actual efforts, and I will put myself as accountable as well, things that we neglect or things that we overlook, AI ethics seems to be almost anything at this point. So I want to put a little bit of history behind it, a little bit of background, and talk first about attribution and manipulation. We've talked about that a little bit already. Talk about the ethical dilemmas that are involved with attribution. I think Bill, you mentioned the uncanny valley and the caretaker. I'm going to get to that. I also want to address LLMs and chatbot interfaces, because those are not traditionally thought of as robots for very good reason. But I do think in some of the care contexts, we do need to include them for several reasons into some of the similar dynamics that we find in human-robot interaction. So then I'm going to turn to care contexts and look at what are some of the ethical contours there that really need to get attended to and thought about in detail, and what difference design should, what differences it makes for designing systems and implementing them. And again, it's a whirlwind tour, so I'm not going to be able to get as deeply into it as I'd like, but to give you enough that you can take the torch and run with your various specialties and your various perspectives, whether clinical, theological, pastoral, spiritual, guidance-wise, what have you. So I'm looking forward to giving that over to you in a lot of ways. And then to carry on, Mark, I'm not going to be nearly as systematic as Mark was about compassion, but I do have a couple of thoughts about what constitutes compassion in relationship to AI, which leaves it open as to whether AI will itself will be compassionate or whether it's about preserving compassion on the part of people so that AI usage does not lead to what Shannon Valor calls moral de-skilling or care de-skilling, where we lose some of our caretaking, caregiving abilities. Okay, the ethical dilemma of attribution. My lab director and frequent co-author Matthias Scheutz wrote back in 2009 about the unidirectional bond that can happen between human beings and machines. Not things like Data on Star Trek, things like Roomba. People that study this kind of stuff have noticed that some people give Roombas days off. Some people give Roombas gifts because of the work that they provide. Now, that may not be you, but it is a phenomenon. I mean, and some people name their car. We don't need overly developed robots to develop certain types of bonds where we give emotional investment, we attribute things to the machine, And there's not any real thing coming back in the other direction. It is unidirectional. This picture on the top right is from an experiment we ran in the lab. I ran some conditions. This robot is a now robot, pretty common used in human-robot interaction experiments. It can simulate crying. We program it to simulate crying when another robot knocked its tower down. Test subjects were instructed to tell a robot or not tell a robot to knock it down, and the robot would either object and have moral objections, but when it did, we ran a condition where the robot cried. And even when you told test participants, this robot has very little, almost no language understanding. It understands go left, go right, go forward, go backward, stop, and knock down. Or, you know, very basic, we stressed, this is not conscious. These robots are not conscious. Even then, just doing the motion of crying, in the results afterwards, people reported emotional duress watching this. So in some ways, we do have to think about ourselves as multi-layered. I can make your frontal cortex understand in the abstract that that's a robot that's very simply programmed, but it doesn't matter on some level. Our attributions are not totally in our control. They are, in fact, instinctual on some level. And that means that even telling someone, or even on a regulatory level, put it on the label, beware, this robot could make you feel some emotions. Even then, that's not going to prevent them. So we really have to be open to the different ways that manipulation can occur. Now, having said that, there are usages, and Mark alluded to the Paro robot on the bottom right, which is an animal. It's not a human form. It simulates breathing. It has a rhythmic kind of breathing motion and a heartbeat, and it has a temperature gauge, so it can be warm. It can be a warm presence. And the folks that study that, the Paro robot, have reported a lot of good results in elder care. So people are not overly attributing a kind of harp seal, or I don't know the species of seal, but it's a seal robot. There's not a lot of over-attribution, but there is some animacy, there is some relationship there. So where is the line between anthropomorphizing and going way overboard to the point of being manipulated emotionally and having distress to having something more beneficial? I mean, even the folks that have, there are even some perverse folks that don't mind Clippy, assisting with a Microsoft Word document. They're not over-attributing something to a cartoon character. Maybe there are ways that people play with a robot where that doesn't come to the fore. So where is the line? That's really the question that HRI researchers really look into, and look at shape, look at motion, look at these different factors. Now, LLMs and chatbots. Does it matter when there's not a body, whether it's a seal body or a humanistic body or something that's moving? Does that matter? I would say, especially as we think about care context, that it does matter, but it doesn't matter enough not to feed into some of the same manipulation dynamics. Because language itself connects to our body, it connects to our senses, connects us to our emotional memories. And I think in the last presentation, I think Derek mentioned about deceased relatives, hearing the voice of a deceased relative that's generated by AI. That's going to be a bodily experience, and therefore, you can't say, well, it's just a screen interface, and so it's not really that physical, or it's disembodied. I'd say not really. The conversation is not shared physical space, but it is emotional space within us, so to speak. Human-computer interaction studies at some of these dynamics, and there's a great article that I teach a lot in AI ethics called The Terrible Joy of Yelling at Alexa, which is a putatively disembodied voice And you can do a social analysis. Why is it Alexa and Siri rather than Alex and Steve? There's all types of gender dynamics as to who's typecast as caregivers. But the kind of pivotal, not to give away the story, but the pivotal moment in there ethically is when Emily and her husband come home from work every day, and it's kind of a habit of discharging on Alexa with various expletives and, you know, insults about getting things wrong. And it seems fine. It seems to not have crossed that line until the two-year-old started cussing at Alexa. And they realized that what they thought of as a user machine interface was a user, listener, observer, learner, a human that was picking up, this is how you yell at Alexa. And even you can debate Alexa's what Alexa represents, but the kid, if there are associations with a classmate named Alexa or women that sound like Alexa, well, what's being learned? So disembodiment does not get rid of the power. And I put the ChatGPT on the left. It seems like a basic comical error. You ask ChatGPT, you know, back in one of the earlier iterations, how many countries start with the letter V? And it says there are no countries that start with the letter V because it doesn't have a lot of retrieval augmented generation at that point. It was, you know, based on its training and tokens that it was working with, it just couldn't do something like look up the fact that Venezuela exists like a third grader might. And it just generates, it doesn't even hallucinate. I don't like that term because it's never correctly perceived anything. It doesn't have perceptual traffic with the world. But it did state something false. And you may have heard of Blake Lemoine, the Google engineer, who on a theologically stated basis came to a point in working with Lambda where he said, I no longer know if this is conscious or not, and it is a theological issue of whether God has created something conscious or not, and I'm on the side of this might have come to life. So disembodiment does not get rid of some very powerful attribution issues. I did want to throw a little bit of technical, I mean, I can't match Cyrus's slides of vectors and things like that, but I will show you a brief picture of the DIARC architecture, which the Human Robot Interaction Lab at Tufts has developed for a decade and a half. And the thing that I would point out is in that schema, against the grain of what a lot of machine learning and so-called black box systems are, which is to say a lot of hidden neural network stuff going on that takes input, relates it in many different ways through many different layers, weights, and so on. Against the grain of that is this is a little bit the old-fashioned AI, where you have things like beliefs about the world and logical inferences. If the light is red, you need to stop. Not simulating a million times what happens with a red light and correlating that with usual behavior, but a rule that from which you can infer. And this retains some of that old-fashioned stuff that you might say is not sophisticated or not robust, but it does make a difference between being able to state something explicit and recreate why did the robot stop at the red light. You can see in the system why it did, because it has a belief of, and a connected structure there. So that's just an issue about when you're talking about moral norms, if you have an explicit norm that does have that base structure, what are the costs of leaving behind that kind of old-fashioned approach? All right, so let's get to care. When it comes to norms and things that to which you would like to design or according to which you would like systems to act, you can think about public spaces. This picture alludes to an incident you may have heard of in Pittsburgh near Carnegie Mellon where a delivery robot blocked the curb cut at a crosswalk. Problem being a person in a wheelchair who needs that curb cut to to cross and get safely onto the curb was stuck in the middle. There was, how do you instruct the robot, the Starship delivery robot doesn't have natural language instruction. It doesn't have common sense reasoning. It can't understand, get the blank out of the way or I'm gonna get killed. It just sits there because it doesn't know what a crosswalk is. It doesn't know what a curb cut is. It doesn't really, it has its pathways. It has its optimized ways from getting to A and B, and it can do that very well. But by virtue of being in public space, you're already in the space of norms. What happens in care context, where the space is not something publicly available and observable, where there may just be a person and a machine, or more ideally, at least a caregiver, maybe loved ones, and a robotic device or automated device, and a patient or a user. Our lab had a grant using a robotic arm to do feeding for those who needed that assistive device. And even though we had the kind of hardware folks and the mechatronics folks that were thinking about angles and speed and what the, how things were going to be picked up and delivered, you're already in a very richly normative space. What if the person says stop? What if the person says faster? Or no? You're already getting into sensitive issues about autonomy and dignity and what natural language instructions will entail. I was fortunate enough to co-organize a workshop for the AI 100 effort on coding caring, where we looked at some of these issues and tried to point out with, we had caregivers, medical providers, we had sociologists, we had a number of different disciplines. We had some entrepreneurs who were floating some apps. Things got heated. in terms of proposals, but it was useful in really getting to put out on the table what was at stake. And one of those being how much time and vulnerability true care takes, despite all the effort to make things more efficient and to make things, systems that would be not engaged in vulnerability. The fact is care does involve vulnerability. It's hard to flee. Stress the augmentative nature of care, preserving autonomy, as we see with the feeding arm. And I have a link to that for when, if you see these slides later. Other things that we looked at, so autonomy, dignity, and collaboration, the fact that the idea of user and machine as a dyad, as just a dual relationship, doesn't really work for care. There's just too much going on. No matter how much ability you ascribe to the system, what happens when the loved one walks into the room? How is that relationship accommodated? What happens when other people in the hospital there, other people in the facility? It has to be more systemic in terms of evaluation, including, as I think, Mark, you alluded to, the social, economic, political pressures on care itself. You can't just throw AI in that system and think those pressures stop. What does that mean for the attribution? I can't get into all of those questions, of course, but for the attribution dilemma that I mentioned at the beginning, which is you can't just shut off attribution, but you know that there are lines that might violate dignity, autonomy, and so on. What I would suggest as an idea to throw out to you is the difference is in an isolating deception, an isolating form of deception that leads the person into cutting off their relationships rather than strengthening their relationships with people. And that you can deceive around common sense reasoning, that the AI system or robot might send a signal that it knows or pretends to have reasoning or planning that it does not have. Obviously that it could have affect or suffering. I'm so sorry you're in pain. What are the ethics of first person, but also even saying something like that, which seems like etiquette, but are you not leading into an attributional trap there? of conveying that. I mean, like having a Roomba say, "Thanks for my day off. I was really tired." You know, what kind of motivation is that? And he said, with the periods of ellipsis, for this community of people, I want to add one that I've never heard of in human-robot interaction discussions, and I wouldn't put in the human-robot interaction conference, at least not at this stage, interpretive attribution. This is a picture of Augustine in the garden in Milan before his conversion, the picture by Fra Angelico, and I thought of it just because on a very basic level, the advice of tole et lege, take and read, there's a technological aspect. You open the text and it's what you see in the text. You need a text that you can kind of look at random, that basic technology, to receive a message. And yes, there's the more, much less sublime magic eight ball that takes in some of our impulses to get a message from an something automated, something that we're not in control of. We need a message from the outside. Well, HRI and HCI have looked at a lot of issues around bias and manipulation in terms of buying things or leading to certain actions directly. But what if we're talking about interpretive manipulation? And I used on the bottom right these chatbots that are talking about scripture or scriptural understanding. What happens if there's interpretive manipulation, where certain messages, intentional or not, are replicated and do provide guidance and do present themselves as having some type of wisdom or some type of secret data-based access to knowledge? What will happen? I am concerned about the use of LLMs in as much as it can lead to that interpretive attribution problem. I use this picture as a kind of token of a person, you know, looking at another person, laughing with another person while holding the robot, as a little bit of an ideal around care, because it's about joint interaction. How do we prevent isolating attribution? I think joint interaction is key, where you and I are looking at the system, you and I are communicating, multiple people are there, and it's not a case of me being isolated and just trying to figure out myself, what is this, what does it know, what is it not? Whereas if I have company and I have caregivers and I have others, then that seems to be a different type of dynamic. And I've seen some of this joint interaction in elder care robot applications, even in hospice work. I talked to a hospice worker at UCSF who has used an LLM with a patient, but used it with them as a creativity tool and as something they laugh about and as something they join. Their relationship is strengthened. There's not a direct relationship with the LLM. It's their relationship, and look at this thing together. This needs to be looked out for tutors the same way. How can that be preserved? And what I would call it is representative compassion, in the sense that it's a conduit or a way to, if we're going to talk about compassion, that it's not trying to hold compassion necessarily. And I think there's some interesting discussions to have with what Mark presented, because I think there's a lot of validity there. But what I would want to say, as the robots at current levels of sophistication, that it's more about representing the compassion that a system can convey points back to the designers and caregivers. And I think of the incident in Brothers Karamazov where Dmitri wakes up and there's a coat after he's drunk and he's had a really bad night. But he wakes up and there's a coat folded under his head. And he's very sentimental and overwhelmed about it, and it's, you know, Dostoevsky's being a bit comical about it. But there's something beautiful about the image of waking up. You have no idea who's put the coat under your head. You know, but you know someone did. Someone has to have folded that coat and thought of you and tried to take care of you by putting it under your head. AI systems, I think, should be more like that. And I'm going to skip this slide for, I think I got that. But I did want to say, as a gospel lesson, I thought of Mark chapter two. I never get to do a homily at a HRI conference. Mark chapter two, with the paralyzed man being lowered through a roof in a pallet. And I would throw out as a provocation, not thinking that as a use of technology in the Gospels, to think about how AI could be like that pallet and the mat. The crowd is what carries it. It's collective. It's not isolating. It's related to other technologies. How do we open the roof? And the focus is on the person's need and getting to the healer. It's not about whether the pallet is conscious or whether the pallet feels pain. And that, to me, is something of a scriptural ideal that I would put before you, as opposed to some science fiction robot stories. When does that healing happen, and can automation lead back into life the way that pallet assists in healing? So thank you.
Very good. Where did that shake loose?
That's a good question.
I texted my family chat and I asked if anybody considered giving our Roomba a day off. And I'm about to see.
I mean, there's some fascinating literature. Military, for those of you that are in the military, have family in the military, the IED detecting dog robots are given military honors in funerals by soldiers. There are many examples of really interesting relationships that happen.
Yeah. Thanks for your talk. As you're thinking about
Yep.
Four laws of the medium. And one of his laws is anytime you use any piece of technology and push it to its extreme, it has the opposite effect. And thinking about AI, maybe some of his thoughts around the four laws.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously a lot of folks that look at AI and information and disinformation and public discourse have used a lot more of McLuhan, but I like the idea of really taking his work and looking at more intimately at interactions. I mean, I've thought a bit about it, and I do know that particular thing. And I think it's right. There is that irony built in, where the ostensible purpose or the announced purpose, once you, especially as you think medium term and long term. Starts to, just like social media, saying we're going to connect everybody. You push that to its logical limit, and I'm connected. I'm disconnected from everybody, especially those people who posted that stuff over there. Yeah, thank you.
It seems like a lot of technology we see it kind of like released into the wild before we really thought about its like implications. So I guess my question is. Have you done any thinking about like how do we teach people like wisdom in adopting and thinking through like new technology, particularly stuff like AI and in healthcare spaces? And,
Right. I mean, the one silver lining about robotics is that having a really successful monetizable product has not really been achieved. Boston Dynamics hasn't done it. Jibo didn't do it. It's hard because it's bodily. And things trip on carpet. The silver lining of that is that we have time, not a lot, but we have time to really say we're not going to just adopt anything. And the pictures that I've used, a lot of those are test cases. They're not things that are being bought en masse. But I think the point is for these easier, these things that are in the ecosystem, we are in a tough spot. Of reeling back, and we do need to think about, and I think we were talking about yesterday in some discussions, we need to think about collectives and intermediate groups, whether churches, whether school groups, whether parental groups, the idea again of being isolated, like me as one parent, like what am I gonna do? Or even, me and my wife together, the two of us are gonna take on the technology. No, there's no way. You've got to have some ways of associative reflection and convening something to generate some trust and some collective abilities. Even just to say, this is really freaky and weird. Even just to note that, I think is important.
Yes, sir. Are there robots that have like ChatGPT built into them mm-hmm. so that they can understand instructions and follow that out?
Right, I mean, there's a lot of work on it. If you go, I mean, this is a very specialized thing. If you go to the Sphere in Vegas, they have, they just put in some ChatGPT robots that I observed talking to crowds. And it was, you know, they would ask your name, they would do some really unnerving things. In terms of tasks and planning though, there's a lot of work on it, but I think it's pretty uneven because of that ChatGPT can get a lot, but translating it into movements is, there's some multimodal generative AI for sure, but from what I've seen, there's still, in terms of reliable planning, a lot of AI researchers are asking, can LLMs actually plan? There's a group at Arizona State that's really doing some cool work on, do LLMs actually plan? And they're pretty critical in saying, not quite. So in terms of doing some cool stuff in the lab, yeah, there's a lot. In terms of ever being able to release it and say, we don't want to, where our lawyers say it's okay and be reliable, a little bit, you know, it depends. And obviously in-house stuff, I think there's probably, you know, a lot more developed stuff at Amazon and Google from what I've seen, but it's a good question and it's something to keep paying attention to. So the slide I skipped over, I did have as an item one case that was interesting because it came from the caregivers, and that was dementia care workers who, there's a researcher at and writer and doctor, Jason Karlawish at Penn, who, you know, has gathered, and some other folks that have talked to people in dementia care. And one thing that they said was, I need a break sometimes. And I want to be a better caregiver, but having a conversation of a person that will have a repetitive conversations 50 times in a row. If there was a chat, you know, if there was a basic chat where the robot could get me through that 20-minute stretch or 30-minute stretch, because it is dull, and despite himself, I get impatient. Despite myself, I have stamina. Why not have, you know, why not build that in? And that to me is interesting because it's the caregivers doing it. It's not the, you know, designers saying, hey, can you use this anywhere? It's people saying, I need that. Can you get me something that would work in that normatively good fashion? So yeah, thank you.
Very good. Let's wrap this up. Thomas, thank you.